Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers? The Home Depot has an idea. Let Mom's Green Thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens. Right now, get Vigoro Potting Soil just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants, indoors and outside. Shop our wide selection online and pick up your order in-store and give Mom the gift of a beautiful garden. Get Vigoro Potting Soil just $8.97 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. See homedepot.com/delivery for details.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Welcome to the Peter King Podcast. You know, I say this every week, so file this under broken record division, but there's a lot going on in the NFL. And I'm going to break it down in a moment with Paul Burmeister, and then we're going to break down the draft with Mel Kiper, one of my favorite recurring guests on the Peter King Podcast. I've had him on a couple of times. And just to let you know, I spoke to Mel maybe an hour before the Sam Darnold trade happened this week. We spoke on Monday afternoon. So unfortunately, I don't get his view in this, but I do know this. Mel loves him some Sam Darnold. So I'm sure he thinks it's a good deal for the Carolina Panthers. But anyway, that's what we're going to do this week. We're going to break down Darnold. We're going to break down the draft. And we're going to talk a little bit about what happened with Justin Fields and Ryan Day and Dan Orlovsky, and talk about how that stuff happens this time of year. And we're going to talk about it with a former college quarterback, Paul Burmeister, my friend from NBC. And Paul, we got a lot to do, but what was your first reaction when you saw the Darnold trade?
I think it's great for Sam. He's somebody that I'm really happy, Peter, that the reports of how well-liked he was at USC continued through the locker room there with the Jets. So even though he wasn't real productive, they didn't win a lot of games. He didn't produce the way he was supposed to. I think he came out very well-respected and still well-liked. And there's reason to still believe. So I'm happy for him. I'm surprised that they got so much in return. I think,
me too.
I forget if it was a conversation with you or Chris Sims, but I thought a 3 was the highest they could possibly expect. And they get a 2 plus a 4 and a 6. So I like the deal for Sam. I did not see it going down in a way where they got so many draft assets in return.
It's interesting, Paul. You know, that Daniel Jeremiah put out a really good tweet yesterday. We're recording this on Tuesday. But Daniel Jeremiah put out a really good tweet, and he basically tried to figure out the point value on the draft trade value chart that all teams use of the compensation that the Jets got. I thought Joe Douglas did very well. He gets basically, depending on where the Panthers pick, and the pick that they send to the Jets in the second round next year, It's going to be somewhere around the 40th or 41st or 42nd pick overall in next year's draft, which to me, I just didn't think they were getting that. And it helps the Panthers, of course, to be trading picks in next year's draft. But you know what, Paul, I've said this all along. There are teams this year that value the draft this year significantly less than they do in a normal year because they just simply don't have the institutional knowledge that they normally have when they're able to scout players throughout the fall, when players play full seasons in the fall, and then they're able to go to their practices in the fall. They have not been on campus, you know, scouts. If a GM loved a player during the season, you know, unless he went and bought a ticket, he couldn't go to the game. And so it's been a weird, weird year. And so I actually think if I were Joe Douglas, I would rather have had the second round pick in 2022 than in 2021. So, I mean, all told, and I agree with you. Look, I'll tell you one very quick story about Sam Darnold. A couple of years ago, I was in their training camp. I think it was 2019. And I spent some time with him after a training camp practice. And he said to me, you know, I listen to your podcasts all the time when you have quarterbacks on. You know, I'll be in the car, I'll listen, or I'll put it on my headphones or whatever. And so he told me that day that he really learned a lot from just listening to other quarterbacks. And I told him that day I was going to go do Drew Brees soon after that. And he said, oh, I'll definitely be listening. And so he was one of those guys who just really always wanted to get better and always really thought of himself as a sponge. Josh McCown, who was his backup there early on, absolutely loved him. So I agree with you. I think it's going to be good that he's going to be able to go to a place where he has, you know, a much better supporting cast. And who knows how Robert Saleh will do or how the assistant coaching staff with the Jets will do. But they obviously have a good head coach in Matt Rhule in Carolina. So I think it's about as good a deal for each team as you probably could have hoped for.
I tell you one other thing that really comes to my mind, especially right now with Sam Darnold. I've always had it on my mind with him, but I think it really fits right now, Peter. I got to know him at the All-Star game that we do at NBC in San Antonio. There were six quarterbacks a year he was there. And I think he was rated number six, Peter. He was like the last guy in. And right then when I got to know him, I'm like, this is a quarterback who he was playing other sports all through his high school. He wasn't excelling at these quarterback camps and 7-on-7s and getting offers in eighth and ninth grade. He was playing hoops. He comes from a volleyball family on the beach. So I think if you want to look at glass half full here, you can really do it with Sam, because whatever he's going to be as an NFL quarterback, I think is still out there. He's still learning. I mean, he just took up football full time much more recently than a lot of these other quarterbacks like Trevor Lawrence, who've been treating it like a job since ninth grade. I think the best or the worst of him is still out there because he's still growing a lot.
Yeah. And, you know, add to that the fact that he's 23 years old. And there are there's at least one quarterback in this draft. I forget which one who's older than Sam Darnold. So, look, I mean, let me just add one thing about where this leaves everybody right now. And look, I think Joe Douglas did a good job in getting what he could for Sam Darnold. And for those who would say, like one of Mel Kiper's points was, hey, it would be smart for them to keep Sam Darnold while they were working on getting Zach Wilson or whoever up to speed. But here is the most interesting thing, I think, from the Jets standpoint. I do not want to enter training camp handing this job to a quarterback who basically a year ago was in a three-way battle for the starting job at Brigham Young. So, and I'm not saying I don't think he should start opening day, Zach Wilson. But what I am saying is there needs to be some investment now, even if they have to trade for one, in a veteran quarterback. As odd as this sounds, maybe even a Teddy Bridgewater type, because Bridgewater is going to be available. But there needs to be somebody who comes in, who is there and who knows his job. And his job is to help Zach Wilson get ready every week. Now, it could be that Teddy Bridgewater wouldn't have the mindset to do that because he still wants to play. But that, to me, is one of the most important things that the Jets are going to need to accomplish. Everybody said, okay, the quarterback thing is fixed. I'm not sure it's fixed. The quarterback situation is now defined because now we know that they're going to take somebody at number two. But, man, I'd be really hesitant of playing opening Sunday against whoever, traveling to Miami and having Zach Wilson face Brian Flores' defense or whoever they play opening day. I think they still need to do something at the quarterback position.
The name that comes to my mind, Peter, is Alex Smith, because he's still out there. And you can talk about Teddy Bridgewater maybe or maybe not embracing that role. I think Alex would. And he's also the one guy who has on his resume, he did this. He lived this whole example that people throw out. Well, maybe you let the veteran play and let your first round pick sit and learn behind him. That worked in Kansas City with Patrick Mahomes. So he's done it before. He'd be the guy that I would go after, number one. And number two, Peter, I think it's a really interesting example of how two smart buildings do things or have completely different mindsets right now. Zach Wilson looks like he's going to come and play right away and be the guy, unless they go get somebody like Alex Smith. You have the 49ers. They're going to take a quarterback at three, and they appear to be comfortable with allowing Jimmy Garoppolo to still be there,
right,
just in case. Hey, maybe Jimmy catches fire. Maybe he's healthy. Maybe he's motivated. Maybe he's the best guy this year, and we're okay with that. And just it seems like the Jets are going down a much different path with how they're viewing their rookie quarterback's first year.
Yeah, I mean, the Jets are in an awkward position, and I agree with you. I think that Alex Smith is perfect. I plan on stealing that as my theory. But honestly, he is the perfect guy because, look, I'll never forget talking to Pat Mahomes, the former pitcher who's Patrick Mahomes' dad. And he told me, in the middle of Patrick Mahomes' great MVP season, you know, his dad told me that Patrick will never be able to repay Alex Smith for everything he did for him. It's impossible. Andy Reid said, Patrick doesn't owe Alex Smith a house. He owes him a mansion. And, you know, so it's clear. And look, Mahomes absolutely loves him. You know, the other guy I was thinking of, except he really can't do it for reasons I'll explain, but the other guy I would really love to see on the roster, not necessarily as a player necessarily, but I'd like to see him in the organization, is Josh McCown, because he was an absolutely incredible mentor to Sam Darnold. And look, it didn't show up yet. But I know that Sam Darnold takes away great lessons from working with Josh McCown. You know, the one other thing, and the reason why it wouldn't work now, is that Josh McCown lives about 170 miles outside of Houston. And I believe that at some point in the not too distant future, he's going to have a chance to be a coach on a very a very smooth pathway to one day being a head coach in the NFL. But over the next couple of years, at least, he really wants to stay home and watch his two sons. One is a senior in college. He now is committed to Colorado to continue playing quarterback in college. And then he's got a junior in high school, a son, who's probably going to be the quarterback at the high school in his senior year, and then could go on, who knows. But this is one of the things that Josh McCown, basically after making a lot of money to be mostly a backup quarterback in his career, this is one of the things that he wants to do over the next 2 years, watch his sons play high school football. And good for him, he's earned that right. But man, I'll tell you what, he would have been a great mentor to Zach Wilson, but they'll have to find somebody else.
Well, at some point, if it plays out that way, Peter, he's going to be a terrific asset to some young quarterback using all that experience, plus his desire to help people with that experience he gained. I really enjoyed your article this week when it comes to all the different ways it kind of attacked one of the main stories in the draft season, and that's Justin Fields and his view or the support he got from his head coach. Was brought up some of the things that maybe mechanically that need some work right now to help him be better in the NFL. And one of the promising young analysts in our business kind of stepping over a line and saying some words he wish he would have done differently. It touched a lot of different things within those few paragraphs. Which part of those are still sticking with you now a couple of days later?
Of Dan Orlovsky. And, you know, I think sometimes, Paul, in this business and how it's become, particularly covering the draft now, the draft, I remember last Thursday, I was flipping the channels. It was the first day of the baseball season, so I was watching some baseball. And so it was maybe 7 o'clock at night, 8 o'clock, and I looked, and here it is, 4 weeks before the draft. And in prime time on ESPN, they have a one-hour Todd McShay mock draft show. And it's just, I guess everybody loves that stuff. It's just, man, it's hard for me to live it all the time because everybody is just guessing right now and making educated guesses. But, man, over and over and over again, it's too much for me. But anyway, my point is that the draft has become an incredible, not just spectacle on the weekend that it happens, but leading up to it, networks and websites are spending tremendous resources and energy and man and woman power to cover it. And it just occurred to me that I think sometimes we can so overanalyze players and prospects. And look, and Paul, you watch, I'm sure you're a regular college football watcher, having played in college and all that, but I don't watch much of it at all. But I did watch Ohio State Clemson in the playoffs this year. And I saw an incredible performance by Justin Fields and an incredible performance while after taking a gigantic hit from a Clemson linebacker midway through the second quarter. After he took that hit and had to go out to sort of catch his breath and all that, and who knows? I don't know what happened. Did he break ribs? It looked like it to me, but something happened. I mean, that was a car crash of a hit. And after he did that, what did he do? He threw 4 touchdown passes. He beat the greatest college quarterback in the land in Trevor Lawrence and played fantastic. And when all this stuff started coming out, well, Justin Fields slipping, I'm saying to myself, this is just a case, I think, of people thinking too much, in my opinion. I mean, I think wherever Justin Fields lands, I think is going to be a pretty fortunate team. And as far as what Dan Orlovsky said, I think that one of the problems in our business is we're always trying to pass on the information that we hear and we feel good about. And that's what Dan did. He passed on information from people he trusted that questioned Justin Fields' work ethic. And I would have been okay with that, even though that is not what I found when I asked 2 people in the league. Obviously, his coach, Ryan Day, is going to say great things about him. But the 2 people I talked to over the weekend, both who are going to be in position to take a quarterback, both said they had not heard that, and they are studying the quarterbacks. So I don't know who's right. We'll know in 3 or 4 years. But I think the other point to make with this is, I think where Dan got in a little bit of trouble is when he said, you know, where's his desire to be a great quarterback? Man, here's a guy, as Ryan Day pointed out to me, who circulated a petition among all Big Ten football players to sign to after Kevin Warren, the Big Ten commissioner, said there wasn't going to be a season. And so the players organized by Justin Fields helped turn that tide. And then if you watch him after getting hit in the Clemson game, to think that he doesn't have the desire or somehow might not love football or might not work at football, hard for me to fathom that. So to me, I look at this and I say, I think Justin Fields, if he goes down, you know, 9, 10, 11, right in that range or wherever he goes, I think teams are going to be getting a good player.
My mind went so many different places when reading. I was reading your article, Peter, and really the 48 hours before when reading about what Dan had said. And if I can kind of just like, I kind of want to look at it. And I know Dan personally, I think he does a good job. And I think he knows, you know, he wished he would have had those moments back. But just in the abstract, this time of year, and you made mention of this, analysts are on so often, so many outlets saying so many words about these quarterbacks or whatever position. There are times when the analysts who are really good analysts, because of how often they're on, they are either forced to or kind of unknowingly take a step over into the reporter sphere. And being a reporter, you grew up a reporter. You gathered those skills before you came on TV, so you had that skill set. But a lot of these guys are good at watching tape. They have a wonderful eye. They're very comfortable on TV. They communicate their message well. But when they have to be a reporter, that's a different world to them. And you know very well, Peter, there are a lot of places you can step into it as a reporter. You can help build a false narrative. You can burn a source. You can say things that really aren't true, but somebody that you trust said them to you and you put them out there. Being a reporter requires a lot more sorting before you speak, and it requires a lot more being careful about your words than just, I saw this on tape and this is what I think and I know I'm right. Being a reporter is a whole different game. And these guys and women, I mean, depending on what sport you're talking about, they end up over there. And oftentimes it takes a mistake or a few moments where you say words you wish you wouldn't have to learn that lesson.
And I think it's a good lesson for Dan to hear. I think I could tell, and I know Dan some. I wouldn't say I'm close to him, but I know him some. We've talked 10 or 15 times. I think he was really kind of wounded by this and realizes that he has to own the words he spoke, but he realizes, you know, as he said to Justin Fields, he called him and apologized, and he said, I realize that those words are going to stick to you, and that really bothers me, and I'm sorry for that. And look, as I say, I don't think he needs to apologize for two guys in who he has spoken to saying that they have questions about his work ethic. That, to me, is I probably would have used a bit of an appendage on that to say, look, that's not something I know. I'm just telling you what people who are studying these quarterbacks in the NFL believe. And a couple of them who I know said that, he may have some issues with work ethic. But I think where he kind of really got in trouble, as I say, is just saying, you know, where's his desire to be a great quarterback? That to me, it just seems, I'm not saying it's nonsensical, but it just seems to be way over the top.
Yeah. I also also had a thought come to mind many years ago when I was working at NFL Network, Peter. We would get to the point of the year where certain part of our team would be covering the playoffs and certain part of the team went to the Shrine Game and the Senior Bowl and the Combine. And I was on kind of that draft prep team. And one of the analysts I worked with and liked a lot, he would always grab me and be like, hey, Paulie, you ready for lying season? You got your helmet on. Are you ready for lying season? Because that's what a lot of these personnel people do. And even if they don't want to, even if they wouldn't view it as lying, they knowingly mislead you about what they think, about what they feel about a prospect or a team's needs. And like to make that point even further, I think it's negative season two for a lot of the people inside the buildings.
Yeah.
They get to the point, like this process, we talk about first round players and that investment and that money and that position of quarterback, they are doing all this work to find things wrong with the player. And when you get to the third or fourth round, they all want to raise their hand and stand on the table and say, I love this guy. This is a wonderful investment. I want his success attached to me. But if that first round quarterback's a failure, they want their reports to have said, told you, I said this was an issue. I said this might be a problem. And by the time we get to this point of the process, it's so negative because it's built to find the mistakes and turn them out there. And sometimes we can all get caught in that trap and report something that we heard before we think, you know what? This guy's 8 weeks into analyzing this player. He's been told to find the negative on him. I need to keep that in mind.
You know, I'm going to disagree with you slightly on this, but only slightly, because my experience in covering the draft every year, first of all, there are people who do this for a living who talk to five times more people than I do. So I don't pretend to be, what I was, say, 20 years ago when I'm covering it every day. I just don't do it as intensely anymore. But I'll tell you what I have done over the years. I've closed my circle, and I've narrowed my circle so that there are, in the next 3 weeks, 15 people who I will make absolutely sure that I talk to. And some of them I'll talk to for 2 hours, because my experience with them over the years is that they're very smart about what some other teams will do. And Paul, the reason I said that I'm going to disagree with you some on this is that, let's just say that the two people who, if it was two, that Dan Orlovsky talked to said that Justin Fields' work ethic is a problem. Let's just say that one of the teams, you know, that one of those two teams drafts Justin Fields. Dan Orlovsky, rightfully so, could go to that person and say, "You lied to me. Why did you mislead me on Justin Fields?" You know, and so, like, I would never talk to that person again. I wouldn't, because now I've seen that he's using me to get out some narrative. And if I thought anybody I was talking to was doing that, I wouldn't talk to him anymore. And there have been people who I just don't talk to anymore because, honestly, I don't trust them. Mm-hmm. And so, but anyway, I've got this circle now, 12 to 15 people who in the next 3 weeks, I will spend a lot of time on the phone with, going from 1 to 32 of the draft, trying to figure things out so that I can write something that might be representative of what's going to happen. And so if any of those people over the years, I felt had told me something, just to send me on some trail, I would not have done it. And so I wouldn't talk to him anymore. And right. So there are times when I feel like I absolutely know who the player a team is going to take. I specifically will not ask the general manager, because first of all, he's not going to tell me, and no matter how close to him I am, he's not going to tell me. Because it's not in his best interest to spill the beans before the draft. But I just really try to find out what teams are going to do. And then when I have a good idea of what they're going to do, and I definitely don't need to talk to that team, I won't, because I don't want to give that guy an opportunity to try to talk me out of it.
Right. And you've worked yourself into that position where, as you described it, your world has shrunk this way, and you just have football conversations with people that you trust, and they trust how you're going to use the information. And you kind of use it. I'm sensing like it you're already down this path of you feel good, you know a roster, you know what a team might need. And hearing their words inside the building just allows you to go down that path with conviction. You're not reporting, "Hey, they told me this." You're just right. Using it for your own confidence. And that is position A. That's where you want to be. And I remember the year Johnny Manziel was coming out, Peter. I was at a function, and the general manager, who I kind of knew, was friendly with, but wouldn't put him in that circle as you described, someone who I really trusted them. He really trusted me. But we ended up in a conversation, and I was convinced that they needed a quarterback and they liked Johnny Manziel the best. I didn't say this GM told me this. Or I didn't report it. But yeah. As I got ready for the draft, I used that information internally for me. I thought I was down this path with confidence, and they went a completely different direction. They hated Johnny Manziel. And I saw that him later, and I kind of high-fived him. I mean, I wasn't upset that he kind of misled me. I think he was doing his job. He threw me off a scent, put me in another way, and it was gamesmanship. And I'm still friends with that person, but I totally get what you're saying. You kind of live and learn. And if you have that small circle of people that you know you can have a football conversation with because they trust you, that's right where you want to be. You don't end up on the periphery with someone that, "I think I could trust him," and then you end up getting burned.
Yeah. You know, the last thing I would say about all this stuff is that, you know, something has happened in our business, and I wrote a little bit about this recently, but something's happened in our business that if you get hired, you're expected, and this is overstating it, but you're expected to be an expert on your, on what you do. So, you know, if you get hired to cover the draft for ESPN or to, you know, or to do the draft for any big website or whatever it is, it's almost like you're expected to know things that you really can't necessarily know. And I think that's where a lot of people in our business kind of get in trouble. You know, we're not experts. We may know more than the general public. I hope we do, but we're really not the experts that the general managers who do this for a living are. And look, maybe they're good at their jobs, maybe they aren't, but they know more than we do. And I think sometimes the general public, I've found, doesn't want to hear that. They just want to know everything that we know. Like in my column this week, you know, and I wrote in my column, I have no idea what the Carolina Panthers are going to do at quarterback. And what, 15 hours later, they trade for Sam Darnold. So good for them that they kept it quiet. But when a couple of people wrote to me, somebody wrote me an email and said, man, you're really plugged in. And I'll probably answer the email in my column. But in essence, I'm not altogether plugged in because, quite honestly, the New York Jets and the Carolina Panthers didn't want anybody to be plugged in until after this deal went down.
Yep. And kudos to you for just, you know, saying where you were with all of it. And this to amplify what you're saying, this time of year is so much more difficult than the season, because the season, there's a game every 7 days that you can talk about. All the fans, yeah, all that we saw, we can have our own interpretation, our own analysis and reaction. Right now, we're not sitting in the draft meetings once a week and walking out and saying, what did you see? Well, here's what I saw. I mean, we're all kind of guessing. And, you know, with our own knowledge of being around it for a number of years and the people that we do get to talk to and trust, hopefully we have some insight. But you're exactly right. We're kind of all guessing. And then in the rare instance, Peter, where you know a GM so well, where like you talked about, you know what they're going to do, you're not going to let everybody know that you know that. You're going to say they're going to take somebody else because you don't want to burn that source. So it's an interesting, difficult spot to be in terms of what kind of information you have and what you can put out there.
Hey, look, there's sometimes in a mock draft where I will never knowingly – the only time I ever knowingly put somebody to a team that and I really don't think it's going to happen is because I need to get rid of a guy who I know is going in the first round, and I have no idea what that particular team is going to do. So I give him that guy. And then, of course, you look foolish, but I'd look a lot more foolish throwing a dart and then keeping a guy who I feel strongly is going to be in the first round out of the first round. So, you know, sometimes you know things and sometimes there's a reason why you do things. But anyway, it's just we're getting into that part of the season right, where, you know, I won't not my favorite of the season. I'll just tell you that much. But anyway, we'll see what happens. Paul, listen, thank you so much for your insight and for batting it around a little bit. And let's go to Mel Kiper. Just a little FYI. I've known Mel for 100 years, and I have really enjoyed my relationship with him over the years because he's a self-made dude. You know, he wanted to do this for a living, and he made himself into an NFL draft analyst. And you'll hear it from him. Just the love, the exuberance that he still has for him. So anyway, without further ado, let's go to Mel Kiper.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
For the world's greatest athletes.
This is the showdown we've been waiting for.
There is nothing like competing on the world's biggest stage.
It's a world record again!
Goal for the United States! Unbelievable!
And when that stage is Paris, anything can happen.
I have never seen anything like this.
How about that?
An Olympics unlike any other.
What a performance!
The Paris Olympics. This summer on NBC and streaming on Peacock.
Happy to be joined this week on the podcast by Mel Kiper Jr., the ESPN NFL draft analyst. And Mel, before we get into this year's draft, I always love talking Mel Kiper history. It's just incredible what has happened to your business. And I want to go back in time. This is, I believe, your 43rd draft. Is that correct?
Very correct. Yep, Peter.
Okay. So let's go back in time and tell me, how did you get started? How did you figure that America needed someone to be an NFL draft analyst?
It's a great question. I think it was the reason the draft tied to the NFL and the building a football team was the actual reason why I felt like there would be a market for a report like that, Peter. Remember, there was no free agency. There were very few trades. And the only way you were going to build your team from one year to the next and improve that football team's personnel base was via the draft. And back in those days, you couldn't watch many college football games. They weren't available on TV. Maybe you had one game, maybe two on Saturday. So I felt like people weren't able to see these players. So to bring them to light, to let everybody know about their history and how they got to the point when they were drafted, for all the NFL teams, even for the college teams that had players, the fans of those teams would be interested in that. And Ernie Accorsi was a good friend of mine, as you know, Peter, going way back to when I was like 16. Met Ernie out at Baltimore Colts training camp, and he encouraged me to put that out and make it available to the public. He thought it would be something the public would crave, that type of information. And I just felt like for one day out of the year, it tied college football to the NFL. And here we are in April, and you're thinking about nothing but, okay, can we get back to some football? We haven't had it since the Super Bowl. So at the timing of it, the fact that the NFL was the king of all sports, college football was incredibly popular as well, that it would be a market for that type of report. And we're talking about 1978, 79, Peter, when that first report went out.
So how did you do it? How were you able to look at players and talk to teams and, you know, being a young kid with no resume. So what happened? How did it happen?
It's a great question. I think, first of all, nobody knew I was only 18. They thought I was 40 when I was doing radio shows all over the country. I was doing 20 to 25 radio shows almost a day, Peter. And they didn't, nobody asked me my age. I never had to say, well, how old are you? They thought I was 35, 40, whatever they thought. And I was doing those types of radio shows, promoting the reports via the radio shows, getting the tapes from the schools, calling all the schools. And I had the tapes, and I had the satellite dish, the big satellite dish where I was able to get games that nobody else could, including a lot of NFL games. So there was a lot of vehicles. And I was on the phone, Peter, for probably 6 to 10 hours a week just getting basic statistical information on players that you can get in a second now on the internet. Right. I had to call the schools, which allowed me to get relationships with a lot of the sports information directors at all the various colleges, the football contacts there. Called head coaches back in those days. You would go directly to the source. Like I said, I was on the phone a lot in addition to watching players and watching games. So you had to work for a lot of things that now become very easy, Peter, but it allowed me, as I said, to get to know a lot of these people at the collegiate campuses and with those universities, which a lot of those friendships I've had since 1978, 79, all the way till today.
Is there a pick you made in the early years, first 10 or 15 years, that maybe you went against the grain a little bit, but is there a pick early on that you're really proud of?
You know, you think about that first year I was on ESPN, Peter, was 1984. And you know how I feel about running backs in the first round. I'm not an advocate for taking running backs in the first round. But in 84, I hadn't gotten to that point yet, Peter. I was still first year at ESPN. I remember thinking, okay, Greg Bell, running back at Notre Dame, was a guy that nobody had projected in the first round. Maybe you did, Peter. I don't remember. But Greg Bell came out of Notre Dame. He was, you know, I thought could be a first-round pick. And I thought Buffalo would be wise to trade down from the middle of the first to the late first and get Greg Bell, who nobody even had on the radar. And they did exactly that, which once in a while you get lucky, Peter. And it just so happened. I had no inside information on them trading down, but I felt like it made sense. And I happened to hit on that. And Rudy Martsky, remember he was covering the draft for USA Today, wrote it up and said, boy, that kind of gave you credibility. I know with Rudy, that first draft on TV, you kind of needed something, Peter, at that point to get some credibility and being it. And I wasn't into predicting. I was more into evaluating, but we also had to predict. And when you do that type of thing and a Greg Bell ends up being a late first round pick after them trading out of them, the Bills actually taking him, then him enjoying a nice NFL career as well, I think really helped out early on to get some positive commentary going, Peter.
I will always remember, because I was watching it live, I'll always remember the 1994 draft when, you know, by that time, everybody knows who you are. But I always thought this, Fred Godelli at NBC, who used to do the draft, you know, at ESPN, Fred said, you know, at first, a lot of people are skeptical of who is this guy. But then after a while, they say, my gosh, you know, he really knows these players. And what I really remember in 1994, when Bill Tobin is, I think he was in his first year with the Colts, as the general manager, you're doing the draft on TV, and you're telling, basically, you're saying that, hey, look, the Indianapolis Colts, you know, they've traded Jeff George. They need a quarterback. They should take Trent Dilfer. And Bill Tobin went on the biggest rant, the biggest anti-Mel rant, the biggest anti-anybody rant that I think I'd ever heard watching the draft, where, you know, he said, in essence, he said, Mel Kiper doesn't know any more than my postman, you know, and I'm not going to let him draft our team.
Right.
Take me back to that day and take me back to what you thought when that happened.
I'll tell you, Freddie Godelli has been a great friend over the years, as you know, Peter, and he was in my ear. And I had no idea, because when the picks are made, once they're made and you go to a remote place where Chris Mortensen was interviewing Bill at the time, you know, you're preparing for the next pick. You're going through where what's the footage going to be, the highlights. You're talking to the people on the set. And I just remember with Boomer and Joe Theismann and all the different people that were involved in that draft that year, I'm talking to Joey T, I'm talking to Boomer, and Freddie comes in my ear and says, Mel, we're coming back right to you, look in camera, whatever, to look directly in the camera and respond to Bill. I said, what am I responding to, Freddie? Because I didn't hear that. He said, just all you have to know is Bill Tobin is ripping you now for what you said about the Trev Alberts pick and Trent Dilfer and all that. And I remember they go, okay. You know, they came back and I had to look in the camera and make a comment. And Freddie took me through all that, Peter. So it was really a case where initially I didn't really know what was said because I wasn't really listening to that. And then to get Mort's version where he said he kept backing off with the microphone. It was hilarious to hear Mort tell the story. But there are a lot of moving parts, a lot of people involved in that particular draft and that particular instance where Bill Tobin, a lot of people say, put me on the national map. I don't think really that's the case, but I should always thank Bill for that. And I always defend Bill because I think if you're in the NFL, this is Christmas morning. You don't want people, you don't be Scrooge here and say this, I don't like this present. I don't like what you did and your fan base. And Bill was defending that. So I really defended him. I would have probably done the same, a similar thing. Maybe not the way he did it, but I would have probably been a little bit more, I wouldn't say outraged, but I would have taken exception to somebody if it was asked of me, say, hey, I would have said, hey, they have a right to, that person has a right to his opinion. We disagree. We have better resources, more resources here. We're making a pick. End of story. I remember I made my best call, Peter. This is the goal of that. The best call I ever made in the history of me on ESPN in 38 years now, back when Eddie George and Eddie Kennison were picked. You remember that?
Yes.
Lawrence Phillips and Eddie Kennison were picked.
Okay. Yeah.
And I said that those picks should have been, the Rams took Lawrence Phillips and Eddie Kennison. I thought they should have taken Eddie George and Marvin Harrison. So I said, I would have taken Eddie George and Marvin Harrison instead of Lawrence Phillips and Eddie Kennison. Well, they went to, I think it was Rich Brooks was the head coach then. And I remember he was interviewed and they were saying, well, you think Mel Kiper will take an exception to your picks? All Coach Brooks said was, hey, he's right into his opinion. We just hope the guys we picked turn out to be really good. And it, nobody ever remembers that, Peter. They had no idea I ever made those comments because nobody in the league went on that rant that Bill did. And that's what made Trent Dilfer front and center. Trev Albers, ironically, Peter, I worked with all these guys. I ended up working with Trev, worked with Trent, worked with everybody you ever had an issue with. Jim Harbaugh obviously said, I'm just sitting here having popcorn watching Trent. You're bringing my name up. You know, so it's amazing how all so many people, Peter, were involved in that day. That when you look back, I have vivid memories of exactly. I can think about sitting here right now. And Freddie in my ear saying, look into that camera and start talking about this whole rant that Bill went on. So,
But when you, when he said it, mm-hmm. were you shocked?
I didn't have time to be shocked, Peter, because, you know, your mind is so cluttered with stats and evaluations and scouting reports and the next team and what they need. There's so much going on, as you know, on draft day with the pick that was made, the picks that are forthcoming. You're always kind of looking ahead, and we're discussing it with Joe and with Boomer. We're discussing what's going on. I'm not really worrying about that type of thing when we're away from our set. And then to hear, I said, well, all you have to know is he's ripping you. And when I heard that, I'm thinking, okay. And I just had a response. Hey, everybody's entitled to their opinion, blah, whatever I said. He has a right to his. We have a right to ours. Because I really didn't know exactly what was said until later on.
Did you ever talk to Tobin about it?
No, actually, I've seen Vince Tobin several times. You know, great defensive coordinator, and on different airplane flights, and never. I remember crossing Bill's path at the Senior Bowl, coming out of an elevator, and we were ways away, and that was it. But no, never did. Never had. All I've said after that was I never had any problem with anything he or obviously Vince had ever done. I had great respect for both of them, and it just so happened I wasn't even thinking, Peter, when I made those comments that Bill Tobin was even in that position. It wasn't like any personal, you know, when you make comments, it's about the players and what you're, it's not about who made the decision. And because, you know, there's a lot of, it's a group effort in making a decision with an organization. Obviously the GM has the final say so, but it's a collaborative effort. So you don't even really think about those types of things. And when he made it that kind of personal thing, it put it all on center stage. And obviously with Trent, ironically, Peter, it's crazy how it all worked out. Trent, I'm Baltimore. I'm Colts and Ravens. Trent comes back to Baltimore, goes out there for Brian Billick and has a great year and wins a Super Bowl for the Baltimore Ravens. So it's amazing how full circle that came to impact the team I was a fan of. Lauren Kuiper's a big fan of. And here's Trent winning a Super Bowl for the Baltimore Ravens after leaving Tampa. So it was great how that all ended up. And like I said, I've worked with these guys and we laugh about it up till today.
You feel like if you're going to have the opinions that you have, you've got to have a certain degree of Teflon to you, don't you?
You do. And you got to really believe in that. You don't say things for effect, Peter. I never have done that. I always encourage anybody coming up, never just say things just to say them. You got to believe in it, right or wrong. I've been wrong as much as you've been right. Anytime you do this type of thing, you're going to have your hits, you're going to have your misses. But whenever you do make a strong opinion or any opinion at all, make sure you believe in it and you can defend it. And then, hey, you don't have to apologize for anything. If you're right, you're right. I'm not going to sit back and do and cheerlead for myself. Oh, great. I never talk about that. Never talk about the misses. You move on and you look forward to the next year's draft and trying to evaluate those players. So I never really just sit back and wonder, why did I do this or why did I do that? I just move on. And we're always looking for the next best prospect.
Give me one guy over the years who you were really right about that you're proud of. And give me one guy over the years, maybe more recently, who you were really wrong about that that his playing career was a lot better than you thought it would be.
Well, I think when you look back at Eric Swan, remember Eric Swan and the minor league football career that Eric Swan had in college and certainly coming into the NFL with not being in any major college and bringing his story out to the public, say, hey, keep an eye on Eric Swan. I think he's going to go in the top 10. He ended up going, I believe, sixth overall to the Arizona Cardinals and had a nice career. So those are the type of things you're really kind of proud of looking back. That there's a player that a lot of people really weren't aware of that you get some tape on, you like the kid and you like his potential and he develops into a really good NFL player. And then on the flip side, I had a high grade on Jimmy Clausen coming out of Notre Dame. I didn't have a high grade on Rick Meyer. He had Rick like 30th or 33rd when he came out. And I'm a big Notre Dame fan, Peter, as you know, big, huge Notre Dame fan, love Notre Dame. And then Rick Meyer didn't like a lot of Notre Dame players that year, but not Rick. And then Jimmy came out his year, and I love Jimmy, and he ended up going to second round. It was a disappointment in the NFL. So, you know, and a lot of things were tied to that, which were untrue, as you know, going looking back about different things that impacted your decision. You're putting your opinion out there. Nobody's going to impact your decision but you. And if you believe in a player, that's what you're going to go with. And I went with my opinion on Jimmy Clausen. He went in the second round. He never panned out into the quarterback I thought he could be, or anybody that was supportive of him thought he could be. But that happens. And like you say, Peter, you have your hits, you have your misses, and you move on from there. But everybody asks, who was the quarterback that you thought was going to be great and wasn't? It was always, I thought Jimmy could be. And I thought Andre Ware was going to have a great career in the NFL as well when he came out of the University of Houston. I had a super high grade when Andre Ware. And Andre, who I've worked with again at ESPN, didn't fulfill those expectations, but had a tremendous college career. And I think that's what you have to remember, Peter. Whether they develop or they don't in the NFL, all these guys had unbelievable collegiate careers, and they deserve to go where they did in the NFL draft.
You know, I want to ask you just a little bit about why the draft has exploded the way it has. I was sitting around watching television last Thursday, the first day of the MLB season, and it was flipping channels, and I put it on ESPN, and there is a one-hour mock draft. Todd McShay's mock draft is on for 1 hour. It's 4 weeks before the draft. And I emailed a friend of mine at ESPN, and I said, I cannot believe that in prime time on the biggest sports channel in the universe, 4 weeks before the draft, that a mock draft is on national TV. And the guy wrote back to me, he says, why not? It's great TV. But I are you a little bit surprised how nutty everything is with the draft and what an industry it's become?
I guess a little bit, Peter, but not totally, because I really felt like back in 1978, 79, that there was, number one, a market for those types of reports. Number two, a huge interest in what was going on via the NFL draft, because the NFL was the king of all sports and college football was booming. So I really felt like that whole, you know, trying to figure, and everybody loves to try to, I guess, you know, to go back to be a manager when you played that as a kid, when you think you want to play along with everybody and you can have your own ideas. Every fan can have their own assessment of players and figure out what this team should be doing or shouldn't be doing. And I thought it was great for TV. I know the NFL fought against that, if you remember back in the beginning. And ESPN believed in it and developed it, and look where it is now. So
isn't it true that early on that Pete Rozelle said, why would you put this on TV?
Yeah, well, you're in the appearance. We're going to call names. Who would? But again, I remember going back, Peter, even a kid, you'd call, I'd be in high school, and you're calling on the phone trying to get the updates. Remember that number you could call and get all the updates of scores, and they'd be telling you about, you look in the paper and you get a real small print of the picks, and this was from this team or whatever, and you follow it that way. But I don't care how you followed it back in the day, where you're waiting for any broadcast to give to tell you on the radio who went and who didn't. And then they'd skip over all the guys and just tell you the name players. And you want to know a lot more than that. So I think what ESPN did was open it up to everybody. College fans who want to see where their team's players are selected. All the NFL fans who know that in order to be a successful team, you better have good drafts, and put it all together. And it became, I think, great TV. And a lot of the highlight packages are unbelievable. Having access to the war rooms, access right away to the reactions of the players, the NFL coaches, the GMs, the decision makers. And like I say, in April, it used to be whatever day it was, Peter, it's changed over the years. But now a three-day period in April, what's better than bringing college football, the NFL together? We haven't had football since the Super Bowl, and everybody is kind of craving it more than ever. And now you get it. You get 3 days to sit back and enjoy what could be the determining factor of whether your team has a chance to go to the Super Bowl in the coming years.
For the world's greatest athletes.
This is the showdown we've been waiting for.
There is nothing like competing on the world's biggest stage.
It's a world record again!
Goal for the United States! Unbelievable!
And when that stage is Paris, anything can happen.
I have never seen anything like this.
How about that?
An Olympics unlike any other.
What a performance!
The Paris Olympics. This summer on NBC and streaming on Peacock.
There's no place like the movie theater. The smell of fresh popcorn welcomes you to a full body experience, while candies and sodas compete for your attention.
Pick me! Pick me!
hoping to join you in the best seats you've reserved on Fandango. It's where movie lovers buy tickets, pick seats, and double up on rewards points all online. All that's left is to walk in, snack up, and sit back. Visit Fandango.com or download the app today for your ticket to the movies.
Has your voice ever given out?
You know, Peter, I think during the draft, I've been fortunate. I haven't had many issues during it. Before that, a little bit, when you were kind of doing too many shows and too much talking and yelling and screaming and having fun, has worn it out a little bit. But I've been fortunate, knock on wood, up until now. This will be, what, 43 years covering the draft, 38 years at ESPN. Haven't had that draft day yet where that's been a problem.
That's good. Let's, in the remaining minutes we have, I want to hit on a couple of things about this year. And, you know, I've listened to your podcast this year with Field Yates and Todd McShay. I think it's really educational. Every Tuesday at 4 o'clock, or most Tuesdays, it comes down. And so my Wednesday morning workout thing in my ears is your podcast.
Thank you, Peter. That's really honored to have you as a listener on the First Draft podcast.
Yeah, I love it. I really do. It's really good, because I think you and Todd are very good at not making it too deep. You know, you basically are able to talk to me like, you know, like talk to people like they're just any fan out there. And so I think that's a good way to do it, rather than to be too scout speak, you know, if I might. But there's a couple of things you said recently that I was really interested in. One was that in all the years you've done this, the 43 years, that one of the most interesting guys, and maybe the most interesting guys that you have analyzed and that you've broken down, is Trey Lance, the North Dakota State quarterback. Why? Tell me why he's been difficult for you and why he's interesting to you.
Well, several reasons, Peter. He's 20 years of age right now. He played one full year at North Dakota State, one AA level. Only had one start this year against Central Arkansas on October 3rd. He didn't throw the ball well. He's 15 to 30 as first career interception. Actually brought them back in that game with his great legs and his great athleticism running the football. He threw the ball and what was it, 14 to 17 starts. He threw the ball 23 or fewer times, which is pretty amazing. A lot of guys throw the ball 23 times in a quarter and a half, as you know, Peter, and he threw it 23 or fewer in 14 to 17 starts. He had below 56.7 completion percentage in five games against one AA competition. Yet, we're talking about a top 10 pick in the first round because he has the size, the arm, the athleticism, the competitiveness, all those great things. His numbers were through the roof. Like I said, only one career interception. Didn't throw an interception at all in 2019. You would have loved to have seen him build on 2019 this year, but he only had the one game because of the COVID and the fact that they only played one game this year at North Dakota State, playing now in the spring. So for Trey Lance, had he played this year? Boy, yeah, and built on that? No question. Guaranteed top five. But without having that year, now you're rolling the dice on a young prospect, little experience at the 1AA level, never proven against any big-time quality opposition. And no, remember, no all-star games, no combine workout for Trey Lance as well. And all of a sudden, you're talking about maybe a top five, top 10 pick overall, at worst top 10, probably possibly top five. That's never happened before, Peter. May never happen again. And I think when you look at Trey Lance, that's a roll of the dice on talent and what type of player he can be 2-3 years down the road. So it's going to be really interesting to see whether Atlanta takes him at four. Where does he end up? Because
Do you like him, Mel?
I do. I think the talent is undeniable, Peter. I mean, the way he can throw the football, his running skills, but it's against one AA opposition. That's what makes him so fascinating and so intriguing, is because he's done it, but against lesser opposition. I even suggested go next year and play this coming year. Go down to play for Sark at Texas. Go play at Ohio State as the heir apparent to Justin Fields. Get that 1 year at an Ohio State at a Texas major college level. Play well, and all of a sudden, you're the number one pick in the 2022 draft, guaranteed. But without having that, now you're only going on one full year. That's it. At North Dakota State, which is a dominant team at that level. He had a lot of games where there were routes. Some of the games where they brought him back, he was doing it more with his legs and his arm. Like I said, only had those 23 attempts and like 14 to 17 starts. 23 attempts or fewer in 23 and 14 to 17 starts. So it's a minimal evaluation games, minimal number of evaluation games, and he's only 20 years of age, and he's a 1AA quarterback who didn't benefit from any All-Star games or the Combine, going in the top five, top 10 overall, Peter. That's almost a once-in-a-lifetime thing, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for a team to bring him into the fold, because I don't think we'll ever see that again. I don't think we've ever seen that before.
I think that's one of the reasons why so many teams, you know, I think that's why Philadelphia traded down from 6 to 12. Yeah, they're going to probably miss on one of the great receivers right up top. But I think Howie Roseman really wanted to have three ones next year. You're going to know the draft a lot better next year. There's going to be a full season. You're not going to have the opt-outs, most likely. You're going to be able to go scout back on campus versus this right. year. I think it's one of the reasons why John Schneider traded two ones for Jamal Adams.
Yeah.
Because he knew that this year was going to be a real crapshoot. I want to ask you one last thing. You basically this year have been pretty outspoken in saying that where people are going to be picked is not necessarily where they are ranked, you know, in terms of talent. You know, that the quarterbacks are almost artificially pushed up the board every year, and no more than this year. You know, with Mac Jones, Trey Lance, Justin Fields, almost, I mean, I shouldn't say certain, but probably to go in the top 10. Mm-hmm. And players who you really love, the three receivers, and you have said that Kyle Pitts is the best tight end, the highest rated tight end that you have ever evaluated. So you don't really approve of how teams are stacking their board, I take it.
Yeah, Peter, it's going to be the feeding frenzy for quarterbacks. It is every year, and I think I understand that. Everybody's trying to get to a point where you can have that elite quarterback. Think about the AFC, all the great quarterbacks in the AFC. Overall in the NFL, there's at least a dozen that are going to be potential superstars in this league. And you got to try to get to that point. So I understand why they're doing it. I just think that's going to present great value. If you can get those receivers down the line a bit, then you get a tight end like Kyle Pitts somewhere after that third, fourth pick, he becomes a great value pick. And some of those offensive tackles like Penei Sewell from Oregon and Slater from Northwestern also become value type picks at that point, Peter. So if they are all moved up, and we expect five quarterbacks to go in the first eight, I do at least, then some of these other players are going to present, like say, great opportunities. I also want to piggyback on what you said, Peter. And when you get into the third round, is somebody going to say, okay, give me a two next year for my three this year? Or if you're in the fourth round, give me your three next year for my four this year. Rather than use that pick when players you're not as familiar with, go for next year's draft, get a higher pick next year where you will get back to more of a normal routine leading up to the draft. So I'm anxious to see how many moves are going to be made from that second to seventh round in terms of teams looking to give up picks. Because as you know, players, teams always fall in love with players. You can always find somebody to want that pick. And if you decide, okay, I'll give you this pick, but you give me your higher pick next year, let's see how many of those deals are made this season.
Mel Kiper, just really appreciate you taking the time and telling your story a little bit. I think every time I had you on my podcast once a couple of years ago, and I asked you the same story about Bill Tobin. And I don't know, I just love hearing the story. I think it's just phenomenal. But anyway, I really appreciate you joining me this week. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. You're the best. Thank you.